When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and miniseries. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes Simon Doonan, author of Transformer, a story of glitter, glam rock, and loving Lou Reed. Simon relates what it was like to be young, gay, and glam in 1972 when Lou Reed's legendary album hit the streets. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today we're joined by Simon Doonan, the author of Transformer, a story of glitter, glam rock, and loving Lou Reed. Simon, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I love the book. This is a totally new perspective for me on a classic album that I grew up with, and one in which I was somehow oblivious to the sexual politics as a 15-year-old in the 80s when I got my hands on Transformer at the same time I got the Velvet Underground VU album. The sexual politics of it it didn't completely blow past me, but it definitely didn't have the same impact that it had in 1972. Why is Lou Reed's Transformer album such a milestone for you personally and for the greater gay community?
Well, for the greater gays, it was a specific moment, 1972. There was a lot going on, like the whole hippie Woodstocky thing was kind of winding down. And in its place was this sort of other strange glam rock festival led by David Bowie, Mark Bolan. And so it was something that a lot more gay people could relate to, you know, where instead of hard rocking Led Zeppelin and stuff like that, there was this very sort of ambiguous, unisex, glamorous camp, very camp kind of movement that was taking place early 70s. And then it peaked, I guess. Mark Bolan came first, and then Bowie with Ziggy Stardust was 1972. But it was a period where stuff was really coming together. And for a gay person like myself, you could sort of think, well, I relate to this. And these boys are walking around telling people they're gay and they're wearing women's clothes, basically. So it was like, oh, wow, I'm not going to be one of those gay people. Like, because up to that point, gay people were You know, the idea of being freewheeling and fun and out in society, it was really just beginning, because before that, it was about being blackmailed, being arrested, because it was illegal until 1967 and longer in some parts of the UK and in the US. So it was a real transition period, and this album kind of nailed it.
And 1972 was a pretty remarkable year for sexual politics. In the U.S., two movies, two pornographic films, Deep Throat and Behind the Green Door, were among the top ticket-selling mainstream motion pictures of the year. Was that did that sexual ethos impact England as well, or was England in a different space?
Well, I think it's important to point out those movies you mentioned, they were playing on 42nd Street. You know, you could see them, but you had to work hard to see those movies. I think what was having a bigger impact were movies like Cabaret, you know, which won Academy Awards and was full of bisexuality and decadence and glamour and transvestism, as it was called back then. So I think, actually, you know, you've got a point about the porno stuff, you know, the sexiness, you know, Playboy, Playgirl, those things were really bubbling up in the 70s. But then the movie that I think really encapsulated what was so exciting to me, which was the fusion of sex and glamour and music and style, you know, like if you think about Cabaret, that was 1972 as well. And it was such a stylish movie that also spoke to me, because I was already, you know, a fashion obsessed teen, or earlier than that, actually. Anyway, so yes. Have you seen Behind the Green Door and Deep Throat?
I'm afraid to say I have. Yes, it's so hard to imagine people sitting in theaters, you know, watching, going out for the evening and watching those. And it wasn't just 42nd Street. I mean, they, you know, played Des Moines, and like they did amazing box office in that year. And there
really?
Was a yes, they were literal, you know, top 10 films at the box office in the United States that year.
Oh, I didn't know that. I just thought you were, you know, being pervy.
No, this was literal box office in the United States. It's you know, one thing I realized reading this book and looking into 1972, because I was only three. So I was in Borger, Texas. So I was completely removed from all of this. Had no idea any of this was happening. But, you know, I've definitely read about the pop culture impact of mainstream pornography. I mean, you know, Midnight Cowboy had won an Oscar in 1969 as an X-rated film, but it was a very different proposition than full on, you know, what we consider now X-rated films that emerged in the mainstream in 72. And it just seems like, and Cabaret also, I think, is an excellent one to bring up. And it just seems like there was a real loose sexual moire, that the sexual revolution of the 60s really came full flower. This was probably the high watermark of that ethos. And then, you know, because there were, like, the New York Yankees baseball players were wife swapping that year as well. I mean, there was public, you know, the movie, Ted, I can't remember, somebody in Carol and Ted and Alice, you know, about wife swapping.
Bob.
I mean, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. Yeah. You know, so it was just this very, I don't know, libertinism is the wrong word. That's more of a 90s ethos. But there was just this devilish sexual freedom and sexual exploration. And it was pushed the boundaries far enough that there was a significant backlash later on, you know, in the 80s, and sets us up for Thatcher and Reagan to come in. But another angle that you talked about
in England, it was called, sorry to interrupt.
In England,
it was called the permissive revolution, the permissive society. It was seen as like, this idea of permissiveness, but you're right. I didn't really know, I thought people were getting those Russ Meyer movies. I'm sure you're familiar with those.
Of course, yep.
Exploitation movies, but I didn't realize the soft porn. Would you describe it as soft porn?
Russ Meyer or Deep Throat?
Deep Throat's
Deep Throat's definitely hardcore pornography. Russ Meyer I would consider as not quite soft porn, but very sexually themed. I mean, it's almost sexual, you know, self-parody. But you know, I'm curious. Yellow was a mainstream box office hit a year or two earlier, and that was, I believe, more soft, what you would consider softcore pornography. And they, there were other movies. But one thing that fascinated me was that you talked about a generational split in the gay community. And actually, I need to cue our first song. When we come back, I'll come back to the question. But let's go ahead and hear, this is Vicious, the opening track from Lou Reed's Transformer. And that was Vicious off of Lou Reed's Transformer album. But you tell this great story about you and your friends who are in the glam scene, or trying to be, aspiring to the glam scene, dressing in glam style. And you go to a gay bar, which is quite an undertaking. It's still underground. And glam rock's not quite what the majority of the fellas in the pub are into. Can you tell us that story and kind of the cultural and generational conflict that you were on the cusp of?
I grew up in an industrial town outside of London called Reading. And after I left college, I went back there and worked in a department store. And my best friend, who was like a budding drag queen, we were sort of all into Bowie and the sequins, the satin, the glamour. And one night we decided to go to the local gay bar, which we knew met every other Friday in the functions room of a pub called the Railway Tavern. And so we thought we were going to hold our noses and grace this establishment with our presence, you know. So we got all dressed up and went down there. But you had to wait till no one was on the street before you entered, because you didn't want your parents or anybody you knew seeing you go in. It was still very furtive. Being gay was quite furtive back then, especially the town we were living in. So we trotted inside, and then, of course, we were already, I think, quite plastered from like knocking back like half a bottle of gin in the alleyway outside or something like that. We were very tawdry. And then we went over and asked the DJ, oh, do you have Suffragette City? Because that was something we were very into dancing to. And they said, no, you know, and they were playing Martha and the Vandellas, bit of Motown, the occasional show tune, you know. So I think we just blasted ahead anyway and did our kind of Bowie moves with Martha and the Vandellas, like waving our arms around. And we both had cigarette holders because we'd seen this picture of David Bowie using a cigarette holder. And we thought, oh my God, how glamorous and how camp. So we got ourselves cigarette holders and we were wafting, you know, these big gestures with these cigarette holders. And one poor older gay, he had this tight lacy shirt on, which was extremely, to us, very Demo Day. And my friend burnt a hole in this guy's synthetic tight lacy shirt with his cigarette. And then after that, we were persona non grata. And I think we were actually asked to leave because we weren't apologetic. Like, oh, we, you know, just, you shouldn't be wearing a NAF shirt like that anyway, or something like that. We were just horrible and feral and thought we were, and very superior, because we were already like packing our bags and getting ready to move to London and try and find the beautiful people, you know, and find a life of glamour and style and hang out with David Bowie and blah, blah, blah. We were very audacious in our ambitions.
Yeah, that was just a fascinating story. I hadn't thought of all the the discontinuities between people in the scene, you know, they're separated by age, united by sexuality, but separated by age and the hip factor. And I thought that was fascinating. And another angle that was fascinating, I mean, one of the first things I learned about Lou Reed was, you know, reading Lester Bangs's articles about him in the Lester Bangs book collection. And finding out that Lou had been subjected to electroshock treatment by his parents had committed him to mental institutions where that was the practice. And I guess we're just lucky he wasn't lobotomized, which had been a common practice just a few years earlier. But that was commonly seen because of sort of a panic that they were having because they were afraid he was homosexual or experimenting with homosexuality. But both he and Bowie are... And I mean, it's not like we're keeping score, but not Bowie especially is not quite as gay as he led people to believe in this era. And Lou, you know, also like ultimately, you know, married a woman, a cis woman, but had a longstanding relationship, you know, with a drag queen as well. But one thing I really thought was fascinating and appreciated about your book is you document these divergences from their public image, but you're also very forgiving of them and put it into this holistic picture. Kind of sum that up and put a nice little bow on it. I've rambled inarticulately, but I'm hoping you can sum up your fascination with their public position and their public personas and what positive impact that had for the community, but also aware of some of the contradictions with their real life or their, you know.
Yeah, I think the thing to remember is Bowie was 25 and Lou was 29. And, you know, I think being a rock star, you know, it sort of arrests your development a little bit. But putting that aside, what they accomplished at such a young age was really incredible. And so I think it was in a very experimental time. And now we talk a lot about gender fluidity. Back then, I think it was... for them, it was more about sexual fluidity, you know, and that was very much a big part of the 70s was love the one you're with, you know, and so it wasn't an exploration of identity, gender identity. It was more, I think they were just ahead of their time and very sexually fluid. So that seems to be what was going on to me. And I think people always want concrete answers. Well, was he or wasn't he? And da, 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 da. But then everything you read about that period and about these two in particular, there was, it just seems to be fluid. And so I don't judge other people's sexuality. And so, like, I just am amazed at what they accomplished at such a young age. Like, imagine being Bowie, 25, and you're kind of in awe of Lou Reed because you're fully aware of what he accomplished with the Velvet Underground. And then you see that he's floundering a bit. So you say, oh, I'll produce your album, even though he's still kind of a bit nervous around him. And because he's, you know, Lou is the man as far as he can see from his earlier work. So the audacity of what they did at such a young age, it's, you know, it's quite impressive. It's a lot more than just going to the railway tavern and carrying on for the evening.
Definitely. And you know, you quote Lou as making kind of a statement of purpose with this album. And what was that statement of purpose? What was he trying to do with Transformer? And who was he writing this album for?
Well, first and foremost, he was trying to have a hit. You know, he'd gone solo. His first solo album really didn't go anywhere. And he was anxious to get some recognition. And then my editor on this book, she found this old recording of Lou talking in an interview in Holland a year or two after Transformer came out. And in that interview, he says, "We wanted gay people to have the love songs they deserved." So in other words, he was saying, you know, gay people kind of were never really addressed musically at that time in music that was current and hip. So he just felt like doing that. And I think he did it very successfully. Like, the album sounds gay. It's very camp. It's very swishy in a fun way, in a playful way. So, yeah, he wanted gay people to have the love songs that they deserve. That's sort of a direct quote from him in that interview.
Yeah, it's an amazingly bold statement of purpose. And it's also amazing to me that he could combine that. The timing was so unique that this was the 1 year kind of you could go gay and go commercial at the same time, and it worked brilliantly. But let's hear one of those songs. This is Andy's Chest, dedicated to Andy Warhol. That flew, I would be a bat and come swooping after you. And if the last time you were here things were a bit askew, well, you know what happens after dark. When rattlesnakes lose their skins and their hearts, and all the missionaries lose their bark. And that was Lou Reed's version of Andy's Chest, which Mo Tucker had sung for the Velvet Underground a few years earlier, but they re-recorded for Transformer. And one thing that was interesting to me as well, coming up in the 80s, as I think I bought the Velvet Underground VU compilation or re-release or unreleased tracks that came out in the mid 80s, the same day that I bought Nevermind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols on cassette. And so I always saw the Velvet Underground just as part of our punk rock tradition and legacy. And it sounded just as palatable as these other punk rock albums I was into that I wasn't hearing on the radio. But it's interesting to get your take on how you and your friends perceived the Velvet Underground albums in the 60s and early 70s, and how you perceived Transformer differently. What was changed musically about Transformer versus the Velvet Underground's work that made it more palatable and more commercial?
Well, the Velvet Underground, I heard about, as did many people, through David Bowie. He was like always proselytizing the Velvet Underground. He did a song about Andy Warhol. Andy Warhol was the Velvet's manager. And he had, you know, you hear all over Ziggy Stardust the influence of the Velvet Underground. He loved the sound. He was thinking about this something that happened a few years prior, but he had discovered it and loved it. And proselytized it. So that's how I became aware of it. And after I bought Ziggy Stardust and read interviews with Bowie, I went out and bought the Velvet albums. And, immediately you see, okay, I get it totally. It's this nasty, edgy, throbbing, pounding music that doesn't really sound like anything else. And Bowie sort of took the tone of it, the vibe of it, and played with it. And when he was becoming hugely famous in 1972, he had Lou perform with him at the Royal Festival Hall. And he, you know, kind of wrapped his big Ziggy Coke around Lou. And because he felt, actually, some people theorize he saw Lou as a threat, you know, because he recognized, well, he's sort of in the same groove as me, and he's very talented and an incredible poetic songwriter. And so he sort of embraced him. And same thing he did with Iggy Pop. Like, these two, he thought, yeah, you know, I get it. They're major and I love who they are, and I don't want them to eclipse me. So I'll kind of embrace them and become their friend and their collaborator, which he did.
And you have a great story in the book about seeing a band that was billed as the Velvet Underground. Where, when, and who did you see, and what was the show like?
Well, I was at university in Manchester, and this is probably 1970 or 71. And our college, a lot of the English universities at that time were very known for having great rock concerts. You know, that was in small auditoriums, so you could see everything, like The Who live at Leeds University. So our college, Manchester, was a very big college, and we had great music continuously throughout the time I was at college. And all of a sudden, I saw this sign, The Velvet Underground, and I'm like, oh, my God, that's them. That's the band that Bowie keeps talking about. So, of course, me and the girls I lived with, we got all tarted up and went, bought a ticket, which was, I think, 50 cents, you know, to see them, something like that. And wow. Watched in awe as Mo Tucker, she came out with a toolbox and her gym kit and nailed the gym kit to the floor. And we knew about their reputation for being loud, but we thought, oh my God, she's going to annihilate us with these drums. So Mo Tucker hammered her drum kit into the floor, which was a great bit of rock and roll theater, you know, building the audience up. And so then the boys came on stage, leather jackets, shades, black t-shirts, which was very unusual back then. A lot of the people at my college were still very long hair. They were still in the hippie style of things. So seeing these guys who looked like street hoodlums, it was so tough and sexy and compelling. And we just rocked out all the way through it. And then afterwards, like, we'd never heard these heavy rhythms like that. It was just amazing. So we're telling everybody, oh, you should have been there. It was so great. And like, you know, it was beyond, and that Lou Reed and da-da-da-da-da, Maureen Tucker and blah, blah, blah. Like, very disdainful of anybody who wasn't actually there. And then in the course of researching this book, I thought, well, you know, I need to look up that concert. And that concert was all the... Lou had already left the band. John Cale had been fired by Lou before Lou left. And so what we'd seen was like whatever was left. And I can't remember the name of the guy. They actually did
Doug
a great
Yule.
Job. And Doug Yule.
And his brother, Yule, yeah.
Yeah, and his brother. They did a great job. No diss to them. But we were under this illusion that we'd seen the real thing. And because back then there was no internet, there were no phones. We didn't have a phone where we lived. No one had a phone. So there was just the New Musical Express and the Melody Maker coming out once a week. And that's where you got all your dish from. So there was no way we could have known that they weren't the real deal. And in a way, they kind of, as I say, no diss to them. They did a great job. We were convinced. But then I read in my research that when Bowie first became obsessed with the Velvet Underground, he jumped on a plane, which was very unusual back then, went to New York just for the weekend, saw the Velvet, went backstage, slobbered over who he thought was Lou Reed and said, I worship you, you're incredible, this is so great. Talked with him for a while, flew back to London, only to later find out that was Doug Yule he'd been talking to. So I thought, well, if Bowie did it, then I don't feel so cringy about having, you know, made that sort of understandable mistake.
Yeah, and as imposter bands go, it was a pretty legitimate version. I mean, compared to, say, like somebody like the Drifters, you know, had replaced their entire lineup multiple times, but were still performing as the Drifters. And the Velvet Underground, they had one original member in Mo Tucker, and Doug Yule had been a member for multiple albums with, you know. But and this was a period when things like an early version of ZZ Top actually toured as the Zombies in 1969 and 1970 in the States, because the Zombies had a big hit and were broken up and nobody knew who they were. And so I've run into this repeatedly. The Neville Brothers were in a group in the 60s that would impersonate Little Richard and Otis Redding when they weren't around. So I've run into this frequently, but this is one of the later episodes of that. But let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. When we come back, we'll talk about the making of Transformer.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So you mentioned some of this. I mean, the fact that Lou Reed's career was essentially in the toilet when this happened, that the Velvet Underground had gotten a lot of publicity, but never made any money. And Andy Warhol was many things, but he wasn't a meat and potatoes rock and roll manager out there getting the best gigs and the best, the most money for his clients. And when Lou eventually leaves the Velvet Underground, He gets a solo contract and makes an album, but it flops, like you said. And he's basically back living with his parents in a very depressed state. And David Bowie reaches out to him, and they put this album together. Tell us about the making of this with David Bowie and his right hand man Mick Ronson, who had played guitar on Hunky Dory and Ziggy Stardust. How did they work together, and how do we know what we know about the sessions? Who are the witnesses that documented this?
Well, unfortunately, there aren't very many. I found out about it by reading Ken Scott's autobiography. He's the guy who produced it. He produced Ziggy Stardust and Hunky Dory. And he was the one who knew how to make a Bowie record. And so he wrote a really fun autobiography, which readers might want to dip into. And he talks about it in detail. And he says basically that Lou would teach the songs to Mick Ronson, the musical structure of the songs. And then Ken and Mick Ronson would work on the arrangements and bring it into the era, into the mode of the Bowie record. And then Lou would come in and lay down the vocals. Like, it was sort of quite programmatic, because Bowie was in the middle of rehearsing for his big concerts that he did that summer that I went to, actually, at the Finsbury Park Rainbow. He did this incredible performance, which is much photographed, and, you know, where he's wearing that little onesie and all the different outfits. Anyway, so Bowie was busy. So they all spent time on it, and they gave it their all, but it was quite organized and scheduled. They worked during the day, and then Bowie rehearsed in the evening. So the other person who talked about it is Klaus Voormann, who was a fantastic guy, very interesting. He had an incredible mystique. He was a bass player. He was also phenomenally handsome. When he was playing in Manfred Mann, I used to think, wow, look at that guy. He's so beautiful with all that hair, long hair, but beautiful cheekbones. And he was really a knockout. And so then he also is famous because he did the illustration for the cover of Revolver. He was friends with the Beatles. He used to live in an apartment with George and Ringo. And he's just has an incredible mystique about it. And he's still alive. I tried to interview him, but he's not. He's sort of you know, semi-retired and not that interested in talking to me. But anyway, the quote I got from him, I got from Ken Scott's book, where he says, Lou and David were like a house on fire. They got on really well. They had a hilarious, funny relationship. They chatted and made camp jokes, and Lou had black painted fingernails already because, you know, he was sort of seeing this glam rock thing unfolding in London and wanting to be part of it. And he said that he characterized it as very happy, jolly kind of situation. And then Ken is less so, because I think he had to do all the really difficult stuff and keep things moving. And so he seems to be less, I think he's proud of the record, but less positive about it. He's a little grumpy about it, which is interesting and fun and very honest. And it was, and they had, you know, Bowie again attracts interesting people like Herbie Flowers and obviously Klaus Voormann. And the fact that he saw the genius of Mick Ronson and gave it full flower on this record and on others. Like, Mick Ronson is a very special person, and your readers might enjoy listening to this podcast by Mick Ronson's wife. And she is called, it's a Moth, M-O-T-H, Poth podcast. And it's called something like The Girl from Beckenham. She was a hairdresser in Beckenham where Bowie lived, and she gave Bowie the Ziggy Stardust haircut. She worked mostly on old ladies in a hairdresser, and then, you know, met Bowie randomly and went to his house when he lived with Angie, and, you know, cut all his blonde hair off, dyed it red, and shoved all this wax in it and made it stand on end. So it's a very interesting podcast that relates to this era. And she did Bowie's hair and Mick Ronson's hair, and she ended up marrying Mick Ronson. So her name is Susie Ronson, and her podcast on The Moth, M-O-T-H, is really a delight and such a fun story about somebody scrappy from nowhere like Bowie, South London, little town. Suddenly you're at the center of the universe, because you're off on the Ziggy Stardust tour doing Bowie's and Mick Ronson's hair. Can you imagine?
Very glamorous and quite an ascension. And I was fascinated by Klaus Voormann's take on it in particular, since he was an eyewitness. And because everything I had ever heard about the making of this album was frankly just bitchy, that both Lou Reed and Iggy Pop seem like they've been... have never forgiven Bowie for helping them out in their careers. It's like that old saying, if you want to make an enemy, do somebody a big favor. Talk about that. Like, what are Lou Reed's complaints about the album, and why did he turn on it really relatively quickly for an album that accomplished everything that he set out to do and more?
Well, like you say, no good deed goes unpunished, you know. But I think it's understandable if you look at it in the bigger picture of somebody's creative life. Like Lou, when he was at college, already at college, he'd written a bunch of the songs that were on the album. So he was very precocious and extremely unusual in his ability to be poetic about songwriting. He's a really, really talented guy. And so with a big ego, why not? You know, so I think, you know, the vicissitudes of being a rock star will really do a number on you. And it's, you know, the stress and the competitiveness of it and the stuff you're not in control of and blah, blah, blah. So I think he made this album with Bowie and he thought, why not? He liked all the sound of the music that was coming out of London, just the sound of it, you know, that it felt new. Everyone was looking for that third generation of rock and roll. And it felt new. It felt interesting. He thought, why not? And it was fun. It's a nice respite for him from the stresses of New York to go and hang out in London, which was a very playful place. You know, it wasn't somber in the way that New York is. It was about showing off, dressing up, being glamorous and having fun. So I think it was fun for him. And then it kind of, people focused on it so much, especially Walk on the Wild Side, that became the number one jukebox hit in America for 1973, you know, after the album had been out a little while. You could hear that in jukeboxes all over America. Can you imagine, like, this song about these transsexuals and transvestites and hustlers and decadents? And so it was very big, had a huge impact, this album. And yet, I guess in the back of Lou's mind as a creative person, he's thinking, this is a Bowie record. I wrote the songs, but so much of it is Bowie. You can hear Bowie singing on it. And I guess his ego couldn't quite ever come to terms with the fact that, you know, the album that really gave him the prominence, even though music insiders obviously know, love and respect forever the Velvet Underground, but the music that catapulted him into rock stardom was this album that essentially had been a collaboration, you know, with him writing the songs, obviously.
Yeah, a great reason to bite the hand that fed. But let's go ahead and hear another song off the album. This is Perfect Day, that later made the Trainspotting soundtrack.
Just a perfect day. Drink sangria in the park. And then later, when it gets dark, we go home. Just a perfect day. Feed animals in the zoo.
And that was Lou Reed's Perfect Day off the Transformer album, the song that was immortalized for 90s people like myself and the Trainspotting soundtrack. Although I was aware of the song, that it had such a huge impact in the film. Another aspect that you bring up about Lou's reaction against the Transformer experience was this Phantom of Rock persona that he developed. You talked about the black fingernails, and he was wearing what we would now call corpse paint, you know, white makeup with the black under the eyes. And again, I hadn't quite realized that that was a stage makeup. I thought it was just something, the way the photograph was modified on the album cover. I hadn't realized that was a whole persona that he had done as his glam, part of his glam packaging. Tell us about that, how long he performed as this Phantom of Rock character and why he turned against it so strongly.
Well, suddenly droves of kind of this growing population of fabulously freaky, gender fluid, cross-dressy, glam rocky people in platform shoes were coming to his concerts and lining up and seeing him as some kind of, you know, messiah of this new movement of unisex glamour that was burgeoning up. And I think it made him, you know, he would talk candidly with his wife. I'm miserable. I feel like a fraud. I feel like a fake, because suddenly he's propelled into the front role. And in the Velvet Underground, they were a group. And then for a while, he was the lead singer. And then Nico did a lot of the lead singing. So he was able to sort of be part of a group. And I think he loved that for the rest of his life. He seemed to enjoy collaborations with people. So being a rock star a la Bowie out front, you're the man, everyone's looking at you. It sort of, he wanted it, but then when he got it, he thought, me prancing around wearing makeup and nail polish and funny outfits, like, is that who I am? Because he'd always, I think, identified as a poet, and he was a poet, and his early mentors, like Delmore Schwartz, were poets, and his interest in music was analytical. And he came at it from an analytical, poetic standpoint. But then he also had that, you know, he's a young guy. He wanted recognition. He wanted to have the fun of it. And then, but then it sort of ultimately was not something that made him happy. It was especially being, you know, dragged up and made up. And it began to pall. And I think it only lasted like 2 or 3 years. And then he put out Berlin, and he reverted to a more somber, poetic Lou that actually people love. That's the one that hardcore Lou Reed fans, they love somber Lou, poetic Lou, tortured Lou, tormented Lou. Lou, the poet, the thinker, you know, the introspective guy. Whereas for me, I love Lou when he'd gone and got this outfit from the shop on the King's Road called Granny Takes a Trip. Can you imagine a shop called Granny Takes a Trip? It's a famous rock star shop where all the rocker, all the Brian Jones and Keith Richards and Nick would get all their clothes. And so that was the Lou that triggered my interest. And the Lou, the, you know, the dark glasses, the leather jacket Lou. So I came, you know, I'm a fashion person. So I love music, but I come at a lot of things from a style perspective. So I was drawn to the style elements, as you can tell from the book, because I focus constantly on that, because I'm not a music expert, you know, like, but I've always listened to rock music and all kinds of music. So, but anyway, Lou. So he wanted to be a poet again. And I think he successfully maintained that for the rest of his career, the identity of the artistic, creative, poetic dude. That's who we think of him as now.
Definitely. And, you know, one thing that I find kind of touching about this album is that in a lot of ways, it's Lou's love letter to Andy Warhol and the factory and all the friends that he had made. And that, you know, he had his own experimentations with homosexuality earlier, but this, you know, his time in the factory was really when he got to be the closest with completely gay men, you know, that people with no ambiguity about their sexuality. And it's kind of a love letter, and he's writing songs for these people, about these people, and to these people. But he also managed to royally piss everybody off with this song, New York Telephone Conversation. Tell us about that. And why do you think he put that? I mean, it's just a 90-second little knock. And why did he throw that in there? And what was the reaction back home?
Well, Andy Warhol and Bridget Berlin, who was another of his collaborators, they legendarily spent hours yammering on the phone every day. And also Fred Hughes, who was Andy's manager and business partner. It was yada, yada, yada on the phone every morning. Who did what to who, blah, blah, blah. And when I heard it, I thought, how incredible to have a telephone, because I didn't have a telephone. And not only to have a telephone, but it's next to the bed. You're yammering, gossiping, wasting time in the morning, just chewing the fat with your glamorous friends that you saw last night at Max's Kansas City. I just thought it was super glam. And then I read all about how certain people felt it was about them. But Lou Reed, it was a small universe. So I think certain people would have taken umbrage. He's not specific about who they were, but one can speculate. And, you know, umbrage might be just like, ugh, saying something like that when they walk past you in the, you know, in the factory or something like that. They did. There was no lawsuits. And I think it was, you know, yeah, they felt it was a diss, I'm sure. So yeah. It would have been fun to be part of it, to go to the factory and hang out with all those people. But Andy, Lou talks about how for Andy, it really was a factory, and he used to nag Lou all the time. How many songs have you written today? You know, Andy was ferociously focused on productivity. As much as they might be gossiping on the phone the rest of the time, it was all about how many Marilyns have we silkscreened today? How many, you know, and he would nag Lou the same way. Write more songs, get on with it.
Yeah, it's amazing the way Andy Warhol nurtured so many people's creativity and pushed them. You read about Prince in a similar way, you know, working with the time, you know, well, add a keyboard part, give me some background vocals. How about doing a dance step while you're doing that? Andy Warhol seems like very much sort of a catalytic personality that just brought the best out of people, would find talented people and push them to be creative. And I also was fascinated, like, I had no idea how rare telephones were in England for working class and middle class people at the time. Tell us some of the, like, what did you have to go through to make a phone call in this period?
Well, you didn't really. Like, I would see my pals and my college pals at that time, And I'd say, oh, let's meet at blah, blah, blah on Friday. And then you would stick to it because there was no way to sort of keep texting, I'm on my way. You know, you were just there or not. And it was the same during the punk era in London. Miraculously, me and my roommate, the one who was a drag queen, we'd moved to London and we actually had a telephone. The first place we lived, there was a wall phone and there were 25 apartments. Little bedsits and squalid apartments, and we had one wall phone, a pay phone. And so that would be jangling all the time, and I would run and pick it up, hoping it was for me. And then I would say, oh, get somebody up on the eighth floor, blah, blah, blah. So it was really, we were under communicating with each other back then. I think now people obviously are over communicating. Back clearly. Then it was, yeah, you had more time to daydream back then. So it's quite hilarious to think how much things have changed since then. And during the punk era, a lot of my friends, I mean, musicians and whatever, but regular people, they lived in squats. You know, a lot of the people who were the Blitz kids, who were my friends, like George, Marilyn, they lived in squats. And I think the Sex Pistols pretty much lived in squats too. They didn't live with their mum and dad. They were living in a squat. So it was very austere, the 70s in London, and but nobody thought anything much about it. You know, it was like that's how things were. It was scrappy and real, and so I'm glad I got to experience it. Punk in particular was absolutely incredible to be in London when that erupted, and it was really incredible. Are you a punk fan?
Oh, of course, raised on it. And I think that it's very clear there's a direct connection from glam to punk. But Steph's telling me I've got to get our last cue in. So let's go ahead and hear Lou Reed's Makeup.
Now we're coming out of our closets, out on the streets. Yeah, we're coming out. When you're in bed, it's so wonderful. It'd be so nice to fall in love.
And that was Makeup off Lou Reed's Transformer album. Oh, yeah. And I definitely, you know, to me, it's like so obvious that David Bowie architected the whole aesthetic of punk by creating the canon, you know, the Velvet Underground and Iggy and the Stooges in particular that he elevated, and that he kind of got erased, you know, when Johnny Rotten and others crystallized the punk movement. You know, David Bowie by that time was seen as sort of a dinosaur rock star and was off in Berlin doing, you know, the next taking music where it was going to go after punk. But to me, it just seems so clear. I mean, from the Ziggy Stardust haircut on, that punk is just a direct continuation of glam, and that Lou and David Bowie obviously were big parks architects of that. And, you know, one thing I really appreciated the book was that you have put in all this work to understand Lou Reed, understand his work, understand his biography, where he was coming from, and you document the contradictions and the things that he did that weren't always admirable. But this overall tone of forgiveness, I just really admired. And I wanted to get you to talk about, you know, how do you see Lou Reed in toto and Transformer as part of his contribution? Like, where do you see Transformer in his life's work? And where do you see his work in the greater context of culture in the biggest capital C sense?
Well, I have this great quote in my book that I found. I took it off a film where they had Boy George talking about Transformer. And Boy George said, you know, if you're a young kid and you're eccentric, you're a little different, eventually you're going to find Transformer, maybe in your granddad's attic, maybe in a junk shop, whatever. You will find Transformer and resonate with it. So it really is a great album for somebody who feels different, queer identified, you know, is into style, glamour. And then you have that Lou, But then you have the whole other Lou, the sort of more gritty, dark, poetic Lou. And so he has different prongs to his legacy, I think. And people love him. They're very forgiving of him. You never hear, you know, he did that album with Metallica, which is quite challenging to get through. And also Machine and Metal Machine Music, which was just guitar distortion, which are all very provocative and avant-garde. And, but people are always like, yeah, isn't he great? Good for him. Why not? You know?
Yeah.
So I think he's an invitation to be creative and free, as was Bowie, who continued that way to the rest, to the end of his life, being quite free and liberated. And I think the reason I'm not judgmental about anything is because I think I'm just that generation of gay man who was raised on camp, you know, where you would just sort of felt you were looking at the world through, you know, rose-tinted lorgnettes or pink glasses, and you're looking from a distance, and it's all grist for your mill. It's all entertaining. It's all interesting. It's all valid. Like Bowie has a famous quote, everything is rubbish and all rubbish is fabulous. You know, so there was this sort of camp mentality that you see more with older queens, because I'm 71 this year, so I'm old, where we're sort of looking at the world in an amused fashion, like everything is kind of fabulous and fascinating and intriguing, and what does it mean, rather than, well, I like this and I don't like that, and thumbs up, thumbs down. That's something that's, I think, been fueled by the internet, where people feel obliged to take strong positions, pro or con, on and everything. And I just, maybe because we didn't have a telephone, I never felt that. You know, I was always like, oh, how interesting, how fab, how intriguing, or how peculiar, you know.
Definitely. And so Simon Doonan has been my guest. The book is Transformer, A Story of Glitter, Glam Rock, and Loving Lou Reed. Simon, thanks so much for sharing your story and for coming on the show.
This was so fun. And you are such an encyclopedic dude. You even know about those cheesy porn movies. I'm very impressed.
I just got it off Wikipedia, reading about 1972. But yes, thank you so much, Simon. It's been a treat. And I learned, I added a lot to my encyclopedia of knowledge with this book. It's highly recommended.
Thank you so much.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, we'll continue to let Motown roll with a discussion of Motown's greatest songwriting and production team, Holland Dozier Holland. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.